This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Recently, a close friend of mine experienced an unexpected loss. Watching their family struggle emotionally and financially made me stop and think seriously about my own family's future. As the primary provider, I know how important it is to make sure that if anything ever happened to me, my family would still be able to manage. So I realized that without life insurance, my family would be left with overwhelming financial burdens. I looked into coverage before, but the process always felt complicated, got endless forms, phone calls, and medical exams, made everything take weeks. So that's why Ethos stood out to me. Their process is simple and 100% online. There's no medical exam required, just a few health questions, and you get a quote in as little as 10 minutes. In many cases, you can even receive same-day coverage without ever leaving your house. Ethos offers up to $3 million in coverage, with some policies starting as low as $2 a day, billed monthly. It's a trustworthy company that's changing the way people think about life insurance. So protect your family's financial future with life insurance from Ethos. Get your free quote at ethos.com/Brian. That's ethos.com/Brian. Application times may vary. Rates may vary.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
All right, it's going to be a big hour. Thanks so much for being here. I come to you from New York, New York, but where there's a lot of action going on, none of it really that good. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West will be with us at the bottom of the hour, talk about Republicans, where they go from here with redistricting, his reaction for the first time since Prop 50 passed over in California. Moaz Mustafa is also standing by, executive director for the Syrian Emergency Task Force, after yesterday's dramatic visit by the president of Syria, first in history, to the White House. And before we get to that, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
And to all those protesters outside, I have one thing to say. It is clear to us which side is winning when your side becomes the violent agitators.
No doubt about it. Turning Point goes into the belly of the radical left beast as Berkeley, as violence erupts, but does not stop a packed house and array of speakers, making sure that this Turning Point rally, the finale of the tour, was a positive one.
Number two.
We want to see Syria become a country that's very successful, and I think this leader can do it. I really do. I think this leader can do it. And people said he's had a rough past. We've all had rough pasts.
Yeah, but not al-Qaeda rough past, and that's what he was. Another first, President Trump becomes the first to invite the Syrian leader to the White House, as the former terrorist state is making steps to be an ally. But is it worth the risk with a former AQ member? We'll discuss it.
Number one.
Either all eight senators who voted to capitulate coincidentally are not up for re-election in 2026, or Chuck Schumer worked behind the scenes to give into the Republicans while still protecting vulnerable Democrats, including himself.
Shutdown over, and could the end be upon us for Chuck Schumer as minority leader? Where do we go from here as it becomes clear this was a devastating loss for Democrats and hurt the entire country for the last 40 days? And we're going to discuss that, too, because we know the Senate has voted to open the government. The House could be open, maybe even have a vote tonight or tomorrow. And then we should hopefully be just a few days away from getting everybody paid. But flight is going to be a problem for the foreseeable future. Moaz Mustafa joins us now, executive director for the Syrian Emergency Task Force. Moaz, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So talk about what you experienced yesterday as you were part of the Syrian delegation to the White House.
Well, I have to say it's been a historic a day on multiple levels. I think what people need to kind of take a pause and take a step back and see what's happening here. They realize that you had a client state of China, Iran, Russia, North Korea, Hezbollah, all these horrific, adversaries of the United States and the world. And today, Syria wants to be aligned with the United States and with Western democracies and no longer under the influence of these authoritarian regimes and dictatorships. And I think that's significant. The other part is this is the first time in the history of Syria that a Syrian president steps into the American White House. And that on its own, I think, is incredibly powerful. But what President Trump is doing here is really engineering the peace in the Middle East with all the countries. And this is very transformational. To take a country that's so geopolitically important as Syria and take it away from China, Russia, Iran, and put it on as an ally in the fight against ISIS is just brilliant.
So yesterday, Syria signed a declaration to join the global coalition against the Islamic State in Iraq and on El Sham, ISIS, on November 10th, 2 days after the government forces conducted a major countrywide operation targeting ISIS leaders and their cells. Now, ISIS is a affiliate of Al-Qaeda. Has the president, al-Shara, really changed that much where it's not only is he not a member of that group, he's targeting that group who are targeting him?
Yes, sir. And it's really incredible. Over the last few months since December 8th, when Assad, Russia, and Iran, Hezbollah defeated out of Syria, there has been multiple joint military operations between our military, Central Command, Operation Inherent Resolve, and the new Syrian government. But it's been kind of below the table, not really officially. And today, Syria is actually part of this global coalition to defeat ISIS. And that's significant because the Syrian government, due to their history, and those that have been watching the last 15 years of Syria could see that you know, the new Syrian president, Ahmed Shara, and even, you know, all these fighters that became now the Ministry of Defense have been in this fight against ISIS in northwest Syria. And actually did an effective job of eradicating it from some of these provinces without U.S. Air Force, without advanced weaponry, while having to fight against the Hezbollah and the Iranians and the Assad and the Russians. And so the experience and expertise that comes in now with this new government as part of this coalition to defeat ISIS is really quite significant. I've had the honor of working closely with the U.S. military and with CENTCOM, and just based on, you know, after every meeting they have with the government and this coordination, I am so excited to see that truly now we can have the enduring defeat of ISIS in Syria, Iraq, and God willing, the whole world. And again, that comes because of President Trump's leadership. I have to say, either no other president, Republican or Democrat, would have taken the bold moves that it takes to not just have peace, but eradicate terrorists.
So you tell everyone your background. I mean, you were on the ground as the Syria was breaking up into pieces. Assad was killing everybody he could to stay in power. You saw how the Kurds were fighting on our behalf, wiping out ISIS the best they can. We have a few hundred, maybe 1,000 soldiers in Syria. So what did you observe prior to Assad's fall?
Oh, man. So prior to Assad's fall, we had a government in Syria that was sponsoring every terrorist organization they can, and completely incompetent or ineffective in at all fighting ISIS. I used to fly all the time to some of the U.S. military bases in Syria. Brian, every night, these brave soldiers were like, in, you know, watching as Iranians were sending suicide drones. We had ballistic missile threats that would be, targeting these bases, and all coming out of Syria. Now, today, nobody targets that. And over the last 14 years, Brian, the worst crimes of the 21st century, a million people dead, men, women, children, elderly, tortured to death by the Assad regime, with Iran and Russia ensuring that he has complete impunity in all of that. But today, Iran is out of Syria. Russia is out of Syria.
But they're Hezbollah, still there. The Russians are still there.
There is a base in Tartus, but negotiations, the Russians are desperately trying to keep this one base that they have, but the nature of their presence is nothing like it was over the last
because I know
years.
The president went to Moscow, didn't he, the Syrian president?
He did. He went to Moscow. As you know, Putin brought Bashar al-Assad and some of those big Nazi-like war criminals and kept them safe in Moscow. And the reason that the new Syrian president went there was to demand that the Russians give Assad to face justice in Damascus. Of course, Putin did not acquiesce to that. But the goal, and I've had conversations with both the Syrian president and others in the government, Russia is no friend of Syria. We have not forgotten what they did in Aleppo and throughout the country. And Syria is firmly on the side of the United States.
I mean, the only way Assad stayed in power is because Russia saved him. and Iran.
Absolutely.
Propped them up. So now it's no longer a thoroughfare for Iran to ship weapons through. However, they've still got like $1 billion into Hezbollah to try to revive that that group, which is troublesome. I want you to hear what the President Trump said about your president, or the president of Syria, Ahmed al-Shara, cut 26.
If you look back at Syria for years, they had the doctors, the lawyers, they had so many of the great intellects. It's an amazing place with great people. And we want to see Syria be successful along with the rest of the Middle East. So I have confidence that he'll be able to do the job, absolutely.
So is that the feeling you got? You were there, right?
No, I was. I didn't attend the actual meeting in the Oval Office, although I was kind of with the delegation up to that and afterwards, and have been also following up with some of my friends at the White House.
Sure.
And spoke to the delegation after their meeting. First of all, you know, that clip that you played, it really gives me goosebumps. I mean, what President Trump, his vision on this is just incredible. And maybe people don't realize this now, but in 10 years or even in hundreds of years going forward, he will be remembered for transforming the Middle East for the first time in maybe the Middle East's long history to a place of peace and a place where countries and neighbors are not at war, nor do they present any threat to each other. And I think that's a powerful thing. And he's right. The Syrian people are amazing, wonderful people. They all want to go home. The millions of refugees that are in Europe or in the regional countries, thanks to President Trump's leadership, are now able to return. We already had 2 million refugees come back to Syria. I mean, I can go on and on in the positive implications that have come out of President Trump's policy.
So what's interesting is the Gulf states don't go along with that peace initiative from the president and Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff. If the Gulf states didn't get a favor back from the president, they built trust. And one of it was, if the story goes, MBS said, would you do me a favor? When you're here, the Syrian president would love to meet you. Would you meet with him? And the president said yes. If the President Trump wasn't making gestures like that and doing, you know, trusting MBS, they wouldn't put him in an awkward spot and taking political risk to do it. When he asked the Gulf states to go along and pressure Hamas to stop the fighting and give up the hostages, they wouldn't have done it. Don't you think it's all related?
Oh, of course. Everything is incredibly interrelated. I mean, it's all related, and it's all... Look, President Trump simply is just a transformative leader. One that comes along, I don't know, decade, every 100 years or more. And what he has done is he has taken bold risks that have all paid off, by the way, with zero negative consequences, if you look at his policy overall. And so not only did he bring Syria away from the Russians, Chinese, Iranians, into the West, and now it's a literal ally in the fight against ISIS, but he also did that while carrying favor with the Gulf countries, whether it's MBS in Saudi Arabia or other nations, you know, in the region. And that, I think, is brilliant. I mean, he did the right thing, and as he's doing the right thing, made sure that he got even more benefit out of it from these neighboring countries. And today, everyone in the Middle East looks towards President Trump to continue his efforts that will hopefully give us a lasting peace in a part of the world that is so historic, so holy to Muslims and Christians and in the Jewish community. It has so much history. And only someone, again, like President Trump, was able to do the massive achievements he has. That being said, Brian, I do want to mention one thing. The CSER Act remains an authority on the books. And President Trump has been very, very clear on that. And so,
what is
look,
that?
I understand.
What is the CSER Act?
So the CSER Act is the sanctions legislation that my team at the Syrian Emergency Task Force worked very hard to pass. And it was signed into law by President Trump in 2019. It aimed at really hindering the Assad regime's ability to kill his own civilians. And because the Assad regime was displacing millions of refugees and then wanting the world to rebuild what he destroyed as homes for Iranians, that provision in the CSER Act stops the rebuilding of Syria. So you know, refugees aren't kept refugees forever. But today, the Assad regime fell, and the Caesar Act should have went away with it, as President Trump ordered. But today, there's still some skepticism. Look, I get it. I understand, and I understand, too, the history of Ahmed Sharaa. I understand people maybe don't know all the nuanced details. But I do really plead to Chairman Mast of the House Foreign Affairs Committee to kind of take away his opposition to the lifting of the Caesar Act and to trust in President Trump's leadership and policy in Syria. So that's the last remaining sanctions legislation. If it's not lifted, American companies that can make millions of dollars or billions of dollars in Syria can't go in, and Chinese companies will come in instead.
Yeah, Moaz, hopefully we'll get that straightened out. Tim Kaine said this, you know, he's Democrat on the other side, on foreign affairs, cut 31.
I'm glad the president is having this meeting. I'm glad that he has signaled, along with a bipartisan majority in our committee, a desire to step back from the sanctions regime that we had against the Assad government to sort of give this new government a chance to show what it can do. The only thing I would probably do slightly different than the administration is I would probably pause the sanctions for 6 months and then sort of test behavior rather than get rid of them.
So, but he didn't, he considers them gone. You're saying, no, the Caesar Act's still there, so they're not all gone.
That's true, sir. And look, I've been working with some great American companies, Parsons, Crane, that prints the U.S. dollar. We've been in touch with J.P. Morgan and Citibank. These are all companies that are really kind of chomping at the teeth to go into Syria because, number one, they can really rebuild the country, and they can have these long-term contracts, you know, that the U.S. can take, again, as opposed to Chinese companies that really then occupy the country from right. kind of a business perspective. And what President Trump understood and what Senator Kaine doesn't seem to understand is that if you leave the hanging shadow of legislation, of sanctions, that they could come back at any point, that these authorities are not lifted, then these companies are simply not able to do this multi-year, multi-million dollar projects. I give you another example. The Syrian Jewish community yesterday,
real quick,
I introduced the chief rabbi of the Syrian Jews to President Sharaa. He gave him a blessing in front of hundreds of Syrians. It's a beautiful moment, again, made possible by President Trump. But we can't rebuild the oldest synagogue in the world due to these sanctions remaining on the books. It's only the Caesar Act. It needs to go. I disagree with Senator Kaine.
I will follow that up. Moaz Mustafa, I appreciate everything you're doing selflessly, just trying to help the Syrian people. And the Syrian government stand up, and they still have a long road to go. A lot of violence still in that area, but at least it's not coming from the central government anymore. Thanks a lot, Moaz. When we come back, I'll take your calls. Bottom of the hour, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. Don't move. Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
So knives are out, it looks like, for Chuck Schumer. Ro Khanna is already calling for him to be replaced. What message do you have for Schumer tonight?
Well, I think he made a mistake in going too far.
Going too far, or how?
He just went too far. He thought he could break the Republicans, and the Republicans broke him. But he did think that. We have good policy, they have bad policy. And there's something, I don't know if it's Trump derangement or are they just crazed. They're like crazed lunatics. But, you know, we have just great policy. We have good people.
So that's President of the United States say Chuck Schumer went too far. Do you know what the critics were saying, though? He didn't go far enough. So he couldn't win anyway. They just want him out. He's too old. But he's not up till 2028. People think he's up tomorrow. He's not up. He's not up this next year. He's up 2028. So in March, he said, I've been through this before. You know, we don't have any leverage. I'm going to have a continuing resolution. Okay. And then he decides to hold out October 1st. And he holds out for 41 days. It really hurts the country. And they got very little when they start back up. And they say, well, you should have held out more. For what? Till we have planes falling out of the sky? Till nobody gets anything from the SNAP program? So I'm not going to defend them. But your problem isn't leadership. The problem is you had no leverage.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I am confident that what we will find in Albany is a politics of partnership that we have not seen for quite some time. And I've said time and time again that the points we raised on October 23rd about freezing the rent for more than 2 million rent-stabilized tenants, delivering universal child care, making the slowest buses in the country fast and free, these are not just slogans. These are commitments, and I look forward to delivering them.
Well, the problem is the governor has already said, I really can't, didn't say it at the Queen's rally when she endorsed him and they would say she was yelling and she's getting yelled at, tax the rich. I thought we were in a communist country. Now that he's governor and he's going to be mayor, she said this, cut 39.
I cannot set forth a plan right now that takes money out of a system that relies on the fares of the buses and the subways. But can we find a path to make it more affordable for people who need help? Of course we can.
And what about child care, though?
Child care, I already committed to.
Right. Universal child care. That should be cheap as well. And, of course, the free and fast buses. Forgot to tell them before the election it wouldn't work. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, the Dallas County Republican Party chair, American Constitutional Rights Union executive director, joins us now. Colonel, you surprised that Mamdani and the governor are on different planes? And you know how state government works. Does Mamdani have the street cred in Albany, in the state legislature, to get that done over the governor's head, who's totally incompetent?
No, he does not have that street credential. And I think that you're starting to see already the realization set in that you can go out and make all these Marxist promises that you want, but there's a system that you have to work and operate in under. And you can talk about this is going to be free and that is going to be free, but where are those resources going to come from? And I think that's the most important thing that he is coming to realize. But yet he has that pressure that is on him because this is what these people want. This is what he has promised. And so you can just look at him. He will start to blame somebody, you know, being at Albany, being in Washington, D.C., being the American people themselves, the New Yorkers themselves. But this will collapse in and on itself, and I think that we all know that. And maybe this is a good lesson, a good civics lesson that these young people are not getting in schools, they're going to get firsthand.
I hope so. But you know when I get the sense? You remember when Eric Adams went up his first day? You probably don't because you're not in New York, but one of the first things he did when he was elected mayor is he went up to meet with lawmakers and said, you got to change no cash bail because it's not working. I'm a cop. And whatever you think, Eric Adams, he wanted to put the power back in the hands of the police officer. And they laughed at him. Well, we'll tell you when we need you, when we need to hear from you. My sense is they agree more with Mamdani than they do with Hochul.
Well, yeah, and I think I was just talking off the air with you know, your scheduler. I believe you just elected in Ithaca, New York, at the city council.
A communist.
There, young, yeah, a communist. So, you know, what is going on in New York and these little, you know, hubs of blue? But I think, again, you know, these things are not going to pan out. You can try to support them. You can try to make it happen. But as Margaret Thatcher said, the problem with socialism, you eventually run out of other people's money. Sir Winston Churchill called it a philosophy of failure and a creed of ignorance. And we're going to see that play out on the big stage, the grand stage here in the United States of America. But I think the big issue, Brian, is I have never seen such an open civil war with Democrats in my life. I mean, we all knew they had.
Well, I'm getting to that.
Okay, I'll stand by.
So the shutdown ended yesterday. It's going to be officially ended tomorrow, and the Democrats got almost nothing out of it. Now, you would think if standing up to Donald Trump is what you were going for, you did it. The longest shutdown ever, and I thought they'd be high-fiving on that. Instead, they want to throw out Chuck Schumer, and they said because he gave in. Gave in. You had no leverage. You just picked something out, the health care you don't need to subsidize. It wasn't a Republican health care deal you need to subsidize. You need Obamacare subsidized. And because of that, you decide you're going to keep the whole government closed. The countless people that haven't gotten paid, millions of people that haven't gotten paid. Mm-hmm. Now the flights that have been canceled. Senator Jeanne Shaheen was with me yesterday. Cut eight.
I think this agreement gives us an opportunity to continue to do that work. We're going to have a vote, and I believe there are a number of Republicans who are going to join us in trying to address health care costs for Americans, but we're also turning the government back on. We're making sure that the people of America can get the food benefits that they need, that air traffic controllers can get paid, that federal workers are able to come back, the ones who were let go, that they get paid, the contractors get paid, that aviation moves forward. So we are going to be able to continue to fight about health care because we're going to have a vote in December.
Yep, and by December. That's a vote. And by the way, Senator Thune said, I'd give you that right away. You don't have to shut down the government at all. So that's why Ro Khanna says Schumer's got to go. Rashida Tlaib says Schumer's got to go. You have Tim Kaine's getting it too. Then you have the whole squad. Seth Moulton, a Marine, says Schumer's got to go. He should have held out longer. So good luck, guys. Go at it.
But held out longer for what?
I know.
I mean, that's the thing that no one understands. And if you look at Senator Angus King in the interview he did on MSNBC with Joe Scarborough, he said, we lost the messaging battle. We had nothing that we could bring to the American people. We had nothing that we could stand on. I mean, if the message is that we're trying to hold out to get subsidies, more taxpayer dollars for something that we call the Affordable Care Act, which now is obviously unaffordable, how do you explain that to the American people? And the big thing is that now everyone sees that there were eight Democrats that all of a sudden decided we're going to vote to reopen the government. So now, yes, everyone sees that this was something that the Democrats did themselves and they got nothing for it. I mean, we can talk about this vote in December, but still they got nothing for inflicting all of this pain and angst on the American people. And I saw it in airports, people sitting there with their flights canceled and delayed. I saw, you know, just one line of TSA open at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. So what are they going to explain to the American people? So, yes, they took out a hand grenade. They dropped it on themselves, and now they're, you know, running around blaming each other when they can't even point fingers at themselves because they blew them all off.
They should be rejoicing in a very good election outcome, don't you think?
Well, yes, but I don't even think you can rejoice in that because you look at Virginia. Virginia is a blue state. I mean, Northern Virginia is an extension of Washington, D.C. New Jersey is still a blue state. So there's nothing really big to celebrate about that. They should have won there. And then, of course, you look at what has happened in New York. I mean, you know, 50.4%, that's not an overwhelming, you know, victory. Yes, he won, but it's not overwhelming.
I want you to hear some more Republicans, Democrats losing their minds. Jeffrey Sanders and Murphy, Cut 22.
Oh, I think this whole thing stinks. And I think most members of the House caucus on the Democratic side are absolutely outraged.
We'll continue that fight today, tomorrow, this week, next month, this year, next year.
What this Senate is about to do is make a horrific situation even worse.
There's no way to defend this. And you are right to be angry about it. I'm angry about it.
The president is kind of getting what he wanted.
It doesn't feel like a gentleman's agreement. It feels like Lucy and the football.
Now you're going to open the government up, and what did you get in return?
Right.
Nothing?
Right.
Nothing? This is the end of Chuck Schumer as we go forward.
I think Chuck Schumer, his days are over. If he cannot keep his caucus together, he needs to go. He needs to be replaced.
My heart goes out to him. right?
Yeah, I mean,
so we're outraged he did it for 7 weeks, and they're outraged he's not doing it for 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 weeks.
You know, it's amazing to me. Chuck Schumer, you know, was the quarterback, and the coach told him to go for it on fourth down and 45 yards, and he came up very short. And now they're upset with the fact that the quarterback didn't pick up 45 yards on fourth down when they were the ones to call the play for him to do it. There was no reason for them to go for this shutdown. And first of all, it was about, you know, people getting kicked off of Medicaid. These were illegal immigrants. Then it was about restoring funding to NPR or whoever. Then it's about the whole Obamacare subsidy. So now, again, what everyone sees is that Obamacare is not affordable. And so this is a great opportunity for, you know, Republicans to come back and reinstate health savings accounts, which is what Obamacare canceled. So from a policy perspective, again, they have no place to stand. They had no leverage whatsoever. This whole thing about hating Donald Trump, you know, getting in the way of Donald Trump, now they have shown that we are willing to hurt the American people just so we can get at Donald Trump.
All right, so from what you know, how many seats do you think Texas redistricts it could deliver for Republicans?
I think they can deliver all five. I don't see why they can't. As a matter of fact, one of those districts there in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, it was taken out of just Dallas proper, and it now has some of Dallas, but now it has about three other different rural counties to the north and to the east of Dallas. And Julie Johnson, who is the current representative, she's not going to play well with her multicolored hair out in Rockwall County or Hunt County or any of the other counties.
What about other states? Would you encourage this redistricting that Eric Holder and Barack Obama went to town on after they left office and people seem to have blacked that out? What President Trump is pushing Indiana, is pushing Ohio to do the same thing. They're looking in North Carolina to do the same thing.
Sure.
How do you feel about that?
I feel that let's take a playbook out of what they have done, and also let's make sure that we have the proper representation based upon the voting electorate of Republicans in these states. What the Democrats are doing, and you know, they're getting F ratings for in Illinois and also California, they are, you know, really suppressing the votes of Republicans there. When you have 40 to 41%, up to like 45% of Republican voting electorate, but yet they're saying, you only get maybe one or even zero congressional representation, even though you are clearly voting for a Republican. So, yeah, I think that that's exactly what should be going on. The Democrats will still have, I believe, in the state of Texas, 7 to 8 congressional districts, and that is representative of their voting electorate, which Donald Trump won Texas by 15 percentage points.
Well, and but, you know, you have 38% of California are Republicans, and they're going to have less than 7 seats. 7 seats was low.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just unconscionable what they're doing. They're doing it out of spite. They're not doing, and I don't think what they're seeking to do in California is going to go up to the Supreme Court. I don't know if it can stand judicial scrutiny.
Over in California? So, yeah, they're suing.
Yeah, I don't think it stands constitutional. If you are a strict constitutionalist, I don't think it's going to withstand that scrutiny.
All right. How did you feel about the president of Syria visiting the White House yesterday?
You know, I still got mixed feelings about that guy. Okay, here's a guy that represents the organization that he's the reason why a lot of our brothers and sisters are not here with us today. Has he had an epiphany and change? I don't know. We need to see. We still have Christian villages that are being burned in Syria. I don't know what he's doing to stop that. So hopefully President Trump gave him some very serious conditions and some criteria that he needs to meet in order for the United States of America to even believe first and foremost that he is sincere.
It is an interesting leap. And I've always drawn this line. So if you need a country, you got to show a loyalty to the country, or show you can be trusted. And I don't know how you feel about this, but when the president went and visited all those Gulf states, one thing that MBS asked the president to do, he said, the Syrian president just got in power. If you could meet with him one-on-one, it would be a great favor to us in all the Gulf states, because we want to see this guy succeed. And the president said, bring him. And he brought him. And I think they really appreciate that, those other leaders. It's like, do me this favor. Who would know 2 months later, when it's time to get the hostages out and force Hamas to at least cease fire and release them, including the bodies, they would pressure Hamas to do that. I see a link with these things.
Well, I think first and foremost that the people in the Middle East, they're coming to the realization is that Islamic jihadism and terrorism does not benefit them. They want to have economic growth and development. And when you see strong leadership in the United States of America, not like what we had in the previous administration, they do not want to be associated with that. And let's be very honest, between Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, these guys have been supporting Islamic jihadism for quite some time. So maybe, just maybe, they are turning the page, but it's because of strong leadership. But I want to see more of this this change. I want to see them go in and take responsibility in Gaza, not American troops, but see them take responsibility. I want to see them eliminate and eradicate Islamic jihadism. I don't want to see Christians being persecuted and prosecuted like we see in Nigeria and like we see in Syria and all across the Middle East.
It will be a nice change. I think they're training them up in Jordan and Egypt. So we'll see what can take place. But I love the fact that they're so engaged. The Secretary of State's been there. The Vice President's been there. Jared Kushner is in Israel right now. Because it's going to take an everyday vigilance in order to have a chance of keeping the ceasefire. Colonel Allen.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Colonel.
My pleasure. And happy Veterans Day to all my brother. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And to you. How many years was it?
22 years, my friend.
22 years. Lieutenant Colonel Allen West on Veterans Day. Thanks so much. 250 years of our military. Thanks, Colonel. Back in a moment.
Freedom speaks for itself, and we wouldn't have it without you.
Thank you for serving our country and being the best Americans you can be.
Happy Veterans Day from the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
By the way, tonight's show will be brought to you by I Can't F***ing Believe It. And what, you ask, is it? Well, it is the Democrats. You remember the Democrats. They shut down the government last month for a very particular reason.
Any deal must secure the extension of the ACA tax credits.
This is about my party saying enough is enough.
Democrats will not back down.
Do not stop fighting.
We're in this fight until we win this fight because we know we're on the right side of this fight.
It's literally life or death. So Democrats have three words for this. No way.
Well, funny story. Yes, Charles Schumer's three words were no match for these five other words.
Democrats cave on the shutdown.
Excuse me? Cave on the shutdown? Huh? Not this forceful, young, authentic Democratic Party that hangs out down by the river and curses in what appears to be a cerulean blue blazer. And I say, way. No, they f***ing caved on the shutdown. Not even a full week removed from the best election night results they've had in years.
He went off. He went off for 15 minutes yesterday on The Daily Show, Jon Stewart. And this would happen. You can't celebrate because for 6 weeks, people didn't get paid. For 6 weeks, people had flights canceled. For 6 weeks, we had the military. We had people, special donors, go to the military and try to keep them whole while air traffic controllers had to deliver Uber Eats. But with the Denver Republicans, didn't budge. All they said from day one, if you want to have a vote on health care subsidies, I'll give you that. That'll be our compromise. And they held out. This guy, Chuck Schumer, whatever you say about him, kept everybody in place for almost 7 weeks. That's an all-time record. But now that's not happening. If they gave in at all, that's too much. They had no choice. Kevin McCarthy gave in because he had no choice. It cost him a speakership. Chuck Schumer gave in March because that's what you do. Mitch McConnell knows there are certain times when you have leverage and you don't. And they did not have leverage. Thune was not going to budge. And it's hard to paint him as some type of weird zealot. He's the most normal man around.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, who are a few weeks away from being led by a true socialist slash Marxist. It's kind of exciting. You know, already we're hearing some pushback from other Democrats about what he wants to do, and we'll discuss some of that. Also, this hour is going to be great. We got Molly Hemingway here in studio. You going to be on out number two, Molly? I understand that. And we'll do a simulcast with Varney and Company. And Michael Henry's going to be with us. He's challenging Attorney General Letitia James. And she has just been horrendous. And she's under indictment right now. So it's going to be interesting to hear about that. Also, a brand new season of Field of Valor. So all those athletes that you watch on the field, did you know they have a military background? We focus on all them on this Veterans Day. And you will love this series, everyone from Yogi Berra on down. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
And to all those protesters outside, I have one thing to say. It is clear to us which side is winning when your side becomes the violent agitators.
That's a very good point, and that's Turning Point USA's John Leone. Turning Point goes into the belly of the radical left-wing beast at Berkeley as violence erupts but does not stop a packed house and an array of speakers making sure the rally rallied on.
Number two.
We want to see Syria become a country that's very successful, and I think this leader can do it. I really do. I think this leader can do it. And people said he's had a rough past. We've all had rough pasts.
Not like that, but I understand your point, Mr. President. Another first. President Trump becomes the first to invite a Syrian leader to the White House as the former terror state is making steps to be an ally. But is it worth the risk with a former al-Qaeda member? We discuss.
Number one.
Either all eight senators who voted to capitulate coincidentally are not up for re-election in 2026, or Chuck Schumer worked behind the scenes to give into the Republicans while still protecting vulnerable Democrats, including himself.
Jon Stewart incensed. He went for 15 minutes off on the Democratic Party on The Daily Show. Shutdown over. Could be the end of Schumer as the minority leader. Where do we go from here as it becomes clear this was a devastating loss for Democrats? Molly Hemingway joins us now, Fox News contributor, editor-in-large of the Federalist. Molly, I cannot believe the level of anger directed at Chuck Schumer so far. You could actually say that he recorded the longest shutdown ever.
Well, he had the longest shutdown ever, and he did it. Democrats did it not to accomplish certain policy goals, but really to have short-term electoral gains. And they got them. So people are mad at him in part because they believed the claims that were being made about the shutdown. But really, the shutdown was to help Democrats have those huge gains that they had. Everyone expected them to win these races, but not by these huge margins. And those margins matter in Virginia, for instance, where there's now a Democrat supermajority. So people are being a little ungrateful. The Democrats are being a little ungrateful to Schumer, given that he orchestrated that.
Does he survive this?
I really don't know, because that, on the other hand, progressives do have a problem where they have a fringe, a radical fringe that is the base of their party, and they never have as much power as they have in primaries.
Here is Byron Donalds, the congressman from Florida who wants to be the next governor of Florida. Cut 17.
I think it's important for the American people to see this once and for all. During this quote-unquote Schumer shutdown, the Democrats argued for health care for illegals. Then they wanted to bring up Obamacare subsidies. They were arguing about all these issues. But at the end of the day, they were sacrificing the men and women of this country and their economic well-being for politics.
So that's the way he interprets it. Is he right?
He's not wrong at all. It was a very painful shutdown for that electoral gain. And then in defense of the people who are angry at Schumer, it did end with them completely capitulating, which was a little surprising, I think, for Republicans, because Republican voters are used to their leadership losing all sides of a debate. They lost the shutdown initially with the electoral results, but they came out of it pretty well.
So what they do is they promise to have a vote on Obamacare subsidies. So they'll have a vote. Maybe there are people that are worried because they say, I haven't done my own study, that most of the people who get the subsidies are in Trump won states. Maybe that there should be somebody addressing Obamacare and trying to fix it. Is that even possible? I mean, do we ever bring up the fact that this is a Democrat healthcare program that needs to constantly be subsidized?
It's amazing to me that the big Democrat goal for this is subsidizing health insurance companies. I mean, that's what the subsidies go to.
Because that's
health insurance companies. And this Obamacare, as it was orchestrated, is just in a horrific spiral that will always require greater and greater taxpayer subsidies to insurance companies, and that the Democrat Party, which used to care so much about the working class, is now in the business of helping out megacorp all the time, is interesting.
And the healthcare company insurance, healthcare insurance companies, are their stocks going through the roof?
And their profit margins are amazing. They also have all sorts of tricks to make to hide how big their profit margins are, and it's all thanks to Obamacare, which has also a lot of fraud and corruption. But I guess we're just gonna keep subsidizing since nobody knows how to stop it.
Well, I think there is, because where are the Republicans going to stand by the time January 30th rolls around? I mean, are there going to be a vote? Do you think they're going to pass this vote? Are there going to be Republicans that waver on letting these subsidies go up, feeling they'll be blamed when people's rates go up?
My assumption is that Republicans – sorry, I'm being too pessimistic probably, but if passed as prologue, Republicans will cave. It is very hard to argue against a government program. And since we had temporary subsidies to health insurance companies to help hide the true costs of Obamacare, those presumably will become permanent since people don't have the courage to fix the financial problems that the country is facing.
Listen to how angry John Stewart is. Cut 23.
By the way, tonight's show will be brought to you by I Can't F***ing Believe It. And what, you ask, is it? Well, it is the Democrats. You remember the Democrats. They shut down the government last month for a very particular reason.
Any deal must secure the extension of the ACA tax credits.
This is about my party saying enough is enough.
Democrats will not back down.
Do not stop fighting.
We're in this fight until we win this fight, because we know we're on the right side of this fight.
It's literally life or death. So Democrats have three words for this. No way.
Well, funny f***ing story. Yes, Charles Schumer's three words were no match for these five other words.
Democrats cave on the shutdown.
Excuse me? Cave on the shutdown? Huh? Not this forceful, young, authentic Democratic Party that hangs out down by the river and curses in what appears to be a cerulean blue blazer. And I say, in a f***ing way. No, they f***ing caved on the shutdown. Not even a full week removed from the best election night results they've had in years.
So he went on and he said how little chance this has of passing. And he talked about what a bill does. And if a bill gets through the Senate, why would it ever get to the House and be successful?
Because the House is so evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats, with, you know, and they are up for reelection every 2 years, it's unlikely to see a real strong Republican opposition. John Stewart is funny. He does a great job of representing his progressive base and audience.
In a humorous way.
It's great. But even though he's pointing out that Democrats caused this shutdown and they did it supposedly for this goal, the media in general never communicated that. And the vast majority of people are not watching Jon Stewart. They're watching the corporate media say night after night that Republicans are in charge of the government and there's a shutdown. So they tied the blame of the shutdown to Republicans, even though every single Republican kept voting to reopen the government and Democrats were not doing that. And in a few months, people will probably forget that there was a shutdown. If they remember it, they'll probably still remember that corporate media mantra that it was the Republicans' fault. And so, I mean, I know people are very happy that the shutdown ended with Democrats completely caving on what they claimed they would never cave on, but they really secured their ultimate goal, which was these huge electoral wins on Tuesday. And that's something Republicans are really going to have to think about going into the midterms next year, lest they want a repeat.
So what do you think Republicans should do? Most people feel as though focusing on affordability, getting inflation down is the key.
Yes. Yeah, so Republicans have in the last 10 years moved away from what they were, which was sort of a foreign policy focused free market radical party, into this working class party that cares about affordability, living means of living, all these types of issues. except that the people who are in the Republican Party, even though they keep getting wins based on largely Donald Trump talking about these things, they haven't changed their policy much at all. And so what is the reason to vote Republican right now? I don't know if they've made a super good case. They're going to need to make that case over the course of the next year. And more than that, they need to think about what life will be like in a post-Trump Republican Party. He won't always be on the ballot. He'll literally never be on the ballot again. And so people need the policies that they like in Trump, and they need to see them actually implemented. And that is something that the Republicans in Congress have definitely failed to do thus far.
But I think the Big Beautiful Bill is his agenda. And it has not even been enacted yet. So that is the economic agenda. They just jammed it all at once. And I think the border and immigration is another agenda. So I think that those are two things that are different. And then when you talk about deregulation, that's the next thing that's coming.
But a lot of these things were accomplished. I mean, Big Beautiful Bill notwithstanding, a lot of these things have been accomplished through executive order, and you need to permanentize these things through legislation. I think people would be excited to see some significant change. The affordability issue is real. Young people cannot afford to buy houses. They can't get jobs. And you don't want people running into the arms of a socialist, but they are going to find that message attractive if they don't hear strong, appealing messages from Republicans matched with action. So there's this is a wake-up call for Republicans, how these off-year elections went, and they really need to have a case that makes sense to the voter.
Right, and they got about a year to do it. I almost think it's going to be like Donald Trump is virtually on the battle and on the ballot in midterms. I think they're going to have a convention and pretend that, I mean, first time ever, they'll probably have a convention in August to get the Denver Republican Party fired up. I think the president will travel everywhere because he feels as though if he loses the House or Senate, his presidency is going to be damaged.
Well, I would say he needs to think that way because he will have – the winners write the history. And if he has some kind of rout, and if Republicans are routed, and if he doesn't get his successor in 3 years – the winners will be the people who hate him, who take away every accomplishment that he's had. So he needs to start thinking much more in terms of legacy and how to make sure that these reforms that he has enacted thus far, that they're able to keep going and bear fruit.
So do you think economically we're probably going to have our GDP damaged by about 2 points? It was estimated that we were going to grow at about 4% rate GDP. Now it could drop to 2 just because of the shutdown and everything involved in that. So that'll be an issue.
Well, and in his first term, you know, he showed a lot about how to handle some of these things through economic growth that can be caused by deregulation. Those things are important, but not enough to deal with some of the downticks that were there either through the government shutdown or through his tariff policy.
So how do you feel about the president welcoming the Syrian leader yesterday?
I was thinking about that. Like, this is a man who literally has killed like hundreds of thousands of people, or, you know, who's been involved in the killing of hundreds of thousands of people. It is absolutely true that when you are engaged in foreign policy, you sometimes have to work with really bad people. In World War II, we worked with Stalin. I mean, you have to do these things, even though these people might be monstrous and have blood on their hands. And the situation in Syria may be better, but it was still kind of striking to see someone
playing
like
basketball
that
with military leaders at the White House yesterday. Did you see some of that video?
Yeah, but this is, you know, this is what is happening in the region right now. And there's just an aspect of being realistic about it. And he is the leader.
Right. No doubt about it. In fact, he sat for an interview with Jillian Turner. And here's one of it. One of the questions I thought was right on the money. And that is his Al-Qaeda past. Cut 20. I'm sorry, 29.
Has President Trump raised with you, discussed with you, your own past affiliation with Al-Qaeda terrorism?
I think this is a matter of the past now. We did not discuss this actively. We talked about the president and the future. We talked about the investment opportunities in the future in Syria, and so that Syria is no longer looked at as a security threat. It is now looked at as a geopolitical ally and a place where the United States can have great investments, especially extracting gas.
That was a skilled parry.
It was. You know, Reagan always said trust but verify. Yeah. This might be very skeptical and verify quite a lot.
Yeah.
That what he says actually bears out.
What I love is that he does despise Iran. He does know Iran kept Assad in power, and he does know Russia kept Assad in power. Even though he visited Moscow, I believe that he gets what the problem was. Already we're benefiting from Iran not legally coming into Syria using it as a ferryway to Hezbollah, although they're getting arms now.
Right. The situation there, if Israel can get along with this new leadership, that will mean a lot for the region.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting. Did you see the Wall Street Journal story today, real quick, that the Chinese are saying you can have rare earth, but just as long as it doesn't go to the military? Here we go again.
Well, but it's a big reason why, again, some of the changes that need to happen in America need to happen that will take a couple years to have work out. And getting our rare earth minerals from places other than China, yes, or Chinese control places is a massive national security issue that everyone should be thinking about.
Molly, we're going to watch you on Outnumbered. Is that okay?
Sounds great.
All right. So it's going to be exciting. And then we'll do Varney & Company simulcast coming up shortly. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think he's been in trouble. I think he is in bigger trouble now. I think Senator Schumer's been there since 1982. My guess is that he won't be leader of the party in 2027 after this election, unless something really surprising happens.
David Axelrod, and he's right. And that's an analytical way to do it. I just don't think he can win. I never thought I'd be spending time on this show talking about Chuck Schumer. But I just think it's funny that they're beating up on him when it was the whole premise of the argument was the issue. You shut down the government, which he knew, told you in March. You don't do that. We don't have the numbers. And there's no reason for Republicans to give in. And they didn't. You know what Tim Kaine got? Exactly what I said 2 weeks ago. He indicated that I don't trust the president to have a vote on Obamacare subsidies. But essentially, if I did, that would be enough. And he did. You know what he also got? All those people that were fired by the OMB director, they got reinstated. And they made sure they got back pay. So he got that out of it. I appreciate that Fetterman and Angus King never stopped voting to open up the government constantly, because it's the right thing to do. You could be as liberal as you want and anti-Trump as you may be, but you have to understand when you have the leverage and when you don't. Republicans in the past, Freedom Caucus, Ted Cruz, when he first got into office, he was doing this stuff. And they didn't get anything out of it. Under President Obama, it was a total win. And this was a win for Republicans, except for 6 weeks of unrest at the airports, 6 weeks of no paychecks to some really good people. And SNAP payments to other people that are hungry. But do you need to look at the SNAP program and find out why everyone seems to be getting it? Yes. Brian Kilmeade Show.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Running for attorney general because I will never be afraid to challenge this illegitimate president.
Tonight we send the message that no one is above the law.
I look forward to going into the office of attorney general every day, suing him, defending your rights, and then going home.
Who wants that position, Michael Henry, running again, challenging the Attorney General over the next year. Five GOP bosses representing New York City are getting behind Michael Henry. If there's a lot of Democrats who don't like Letitia James. Michael, you got 46% of the vote last time. What did you learn that time that will maybe make you a winner this time?
Sure. Well, the first thing, thank you for having me here. What I learned last time is you have to really start early. There's also a matching funds program statewide, which wasn't there last time. So I've already qualified for over seven figures in that program. I also think the dynamic is much different. After the last election, I said to myself, you know what, I'll go back into my private life. And I did not think in 3 years the damage could be done to this state that's been done. So, for example, we had no one ever heard the term trade de agua in 2022. You've had a migrant crisis. You have a war in agriculture. Energy costs are through the roof. You had 3,000 correctional officers fired upstate by Kathy Hochul and Letitia James, whose families rely on that. And it's one of the biggest employers upstate. And then they barred them from getting other civil servant employment. Because they went on strike because of the conditions of the – based on the HALT Act, where the prison system is out of control in this state, and the COs are basically so over-monitored that the prisons are out of control. The COs can't really do their job. And she fired them based on the strike, but then barred them from other local employment. Now, areas where I do what I see different this time is number one, I think we could increase our Hispanic per capita vote. President Trump increased in the Bronx 22% in 2024, 21% in Queens, won a lot of predominantly Spanish-speaking district in Queens. Why is that important? Because that's six figures worth of votes. There was 300,000 New Yorkers that voted for President Trump for president in 2024 that did not vote for governor in 2022. There was over 100,000 Jewish New Yorkers in Israel who voted for president. Probably over 80% of them voted for Donald Trump. They did not vote for governor or attorney general in 2022. So there's a lot of votes out there. We will also work to increase our upstate turnout, especially among independents. And I think this time around, also doing a little bit of a better job with the women vote, which it looks like we are going to have a young mom as our gubernatorial nominee, which will make it obviously easier to get across to the women voters.
And you had Lee Zeldin come within 6 points of the governor's race Correct. Last time, and Kathy Hochul, unproven, weak on crime. She quickly tried to change her persona. And I don't know how effective it was, but she did hold on to victory. Now, Lee Stefanik's mantra is she's the worst governor in America. Is that how you grade her?
Look, she could sit here all this stuff trying to act like she's tough on crime. She cannot mask it. We had a woman lit on fire like a Duraflame log on the subway by a migrant. She panicked on the migrant crisis, did not know how to respond to it. And quite frankly, she was pandering to Biden because she wanted to get an ambassadorship. She doubled down on bail reform. She's behind Raise the Age. She's behind Clean Slate. She's behind Less is More. She made no real changes to discovery reform, which is causing a huge drug epidemic and drug trafficking problem throughout this state. She's not removed one person from the parole board that's let out over 43 cop killers. So for Kathy Hochul to try and act like she's missed law and order, it's a complete joke. And look at the judges she's appointed to the judiciary, which are pretty far left-wing judges. So she is not law and order, nor is Letitia James.
So here's more from Letitia James. Now she's indicted on mortgage fraud. She's fighting back. Cut 41.
Donald Trump said that he wanted, he called me all kind of names. And he directed the Department of Justice to investigate my affairs. And they're using mortgage fraud as the vehicle upon which they're investigating myself, Adam Schiff, Ms. Cook, Lisa Cook, and countless others. And it is most of it, as you know, is frivolous. It's baseless because in order to prove mortgage fraud, one has to prove intent. And that's a very high standard, a very high bar to meet.
Is that true, Michael?
If you notice what she's saying, you have to prove intent. She didn't say, I didn't do it. She said, you have to prove intent. I practice in this city. I was in a courthouse where the Trump kids were being brought into that courthouse where she marched Ivanka Trump in like a criminal. And now she wants to go out and act like she's the victim. And everybody that's backing her says, this is weaponization. It's politics. Nobody said she didn't do it. You could go to the ACRIS filing court system in New York City. You will see two mortgage notes on two different occasions that says husband and wife between her and her father. You could go in the Virginia County Clerk. In 2020, she signs a second home rider, and then on her tax returns, she writes it off and gets a $19,000 write-off for an investment property. In 2023, when she said she was helping her young niece be able to get a property to raise her young children, by the way, the niece is like 55 years old and the kids are in their 20s, she has a power of attorney she's trying to hide behind that she signed that says, I hereby attest this is my primary residence, and two attorneys in her office witnessed it and notarized it. She has a 5-family property that she did a mortgage as a 4-family to get around the commercial unit of it. There's a thing about that we've seen about a HELOC loan that when she was in city government, some kind of not-for-profit group, she got money pushed to, gave her a HELOC loan, a home equity line of credit, at a zero interest rate, and she apparently did no repairs to her property. So she can't have this both ways. She can't say, I was trained by the best, I'm the best of the best, and I know what I'm doing, or turn and then that means she had the intent, she knew what she was doing, or she lacks the basic reading comprehension school skills of a middle schooler, because I could bring a mortgage application into any elementary school kid, put it in front of them, and they're going to say, I'm not married to my dad, I don't live in Virginia. She can't have it both ways. And if I, as a practicing attorney, did 5 or 6 real estate closings that bad, I would be in front of the bar for malpractice. She knows what she did. She never says I didn't do it. She says you can't prove intent, and it's weaponization. And the reality is it's all in the public record.
You know what she wanted to do to Trump. She wanted 100%. To give up all his properties. She wanted to stop him from getting that bond to post that bond. She wanted to sit in Trump Tower and auction it off.
Yep.
And she got close.
And the most liberal appellate court in the state of New York, one of the most liberal appellate courts in the United States, tossed the $500 million judgment. And by the way, when you go through the trial, number one, the banks not only continue to do business with them, they said they were paid back in full and made a lot of profit.
So there is no guilt. There's no victim.
It's like if I came to you and I said, Brian, can I borrow $100,000? I'll pay you back by April 1st. And you say to me, well, and I'll pay you with interest. And you say to me, well, how are you going to get the money? I say, look, I'm waiting for my cousin to give me $100,000, $150,000 by March 15th. And I pay you back by April 1st with interest. And you say to me, oh, your cousin gave you the money? I say, no, but you know, you're still paid back in full, so it's all good. That's kind of what she was implying he did. The money was paid back.
Yeah.
And I'm not his defense attorney anyway, but I practice commercial litigation. And I've seen the arguments. She uses the executive law, trying to set a precedent for a law that's ever rarely used to go after him. The courts questioned, were there real victims? Who are the victims? Who do we disperse the money to? They were worried about a statute of limitations. And on top of it, let's be realistic. It wasn't all about Donald Trump. They were afraid of giving her that much power to go after businesses in the city of New York that could help her basically destroy the real estate and financial sector.
Michael Henry's here. You're a Republican?
100%.
Running against Letitia James, got 46% last time, wants to get the victory this time. That's a good point. I forgot about how many business people said, I'm not going to risk this. I'm not going to risk coming in here that I might be labeled a conservative or a moderate or not all in on Joe Biden. And then you're going to come after me next time. Why take that risk? Florida's calling my name. There's plenty of other places like this place called Texas, and Dallas is growing so much as a financial sector. So that's huge. What about this role of the socialist, communist, Marxist mayor? How does that affect your campaign?
Well, first off, I'm hoping he's not as bad as I expect him to be. I think, you know, everybody's talking about how he's a communist, he's an anti-Semite. I think the one thing that's been lost in all this is the guy's never had a real job. He's never showed up 5 days a week to a job. So when there's a blizzard and you have to get the sanitation trucks out, there's a structural collapse, there's some civil...
You work in 20 hours a day.
Right. Civil unrest with law enforcement. Does anybody think that this practice smile and word salad is going to be able to handle the situation? We've already seen some of the people he's looking to appoint in positions like Lina Khan, who's really scared the business community. Quite frankly, I think that he basically stole President Trump's message on affordability. I think it was pretty smart. But I also think that the messaging or holding him accountable wasn't the best, I would say, from the other two candidates running. At times, they lost focus on Mamdani. And 50% of New Yorkers in New York City voted against this guy. Almost as many people voted against him as voted for him. So my anticipation is we're going to have to be a check in the state government to be able to make sure
people might be more open to you. I think people might be more open to Elise Stefanik against Hochul and you, Michael Henry, against Letitia James.
Absolutely. And that's what we're seeing. There's a lot of like common sense Democrats, especially in the outer boroughs, that are really afraid of him. And then the suburbs, I mean, there's people that I know, for example, in like Westchester County.
And we had no say in it.
Yeah.
I'm in Nassau County.
Right.
But I work here every day, and when it comes to law and order, I'm expecting the worst.
And that's the thing. If you're in the suburbs, your kid might take the train in for school or work. Your husband or wife might take the train in, and you're scared. You're worried.
Right. And Michael Henry, just go out there and state your case. I wish you all the best. It got till November. Best of luck.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Simulcast with Stuart Varney next.
Now the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Got a couple of minutes before Stuart Varney pops on, and then we'll do a simulcast on FBN. You can watch it on television, see what it looks like side by side. Also, right afterwards, I got some emails, but I also would love to see what you have to say. I see some of the lines filling up, 1-866-408-7669. So in a matter of moments, we'll be able to listen to Stuart. And, of course, he'll be able to hear me, and I'll be able to hear him. The other thing is to keep in mind, History, Liberty, and Laughs coming up February 15th. I believe that's 14th. I believe it's Valentine's Day. Let's listen in.
This Tuesday morning. It is now 10:51 Eastern time. That means it's time for, it miraculously appears, there is Brian Kilmeade. Brian, do you hear this? Zoran Mandami has hired Elie Biskard Church as his chief of staff. He's the chief architect of Mandami's plan to replace police officers with mental health professionals. It sounds like Mandami's moving even further to the left, doesn't it?
It does. You know, Kathy Hochul kind of stopped him in his tracks yesterday by saying, oh, by the way, we're not giving free buses. We need this thing called revenue. That's why I have congestion pricing, which is ridiculous, because they say we don't have any money for the MTA. So I'm not going to make that free. And then, of course, he names his staff, and you shouldn't be surprised. As left-wing as possible, key aide to him, or he's firing, you know, de Blasio's people, the worst mayor in my memory. I've never seen a guy ruin a great city before like de Blasio did, lazy and ineffective. And he looks up to Mandami, so it does not surprise me. I'm hearing, you know, the FDNY commissioner left already. He says, I'm out.
Yep.
I would not be surprised. If Jessica Tisch sticks around, that's one thing. That's 50-50. But she's a very effective, if you don't know around the country, an extremely effective, proven leader of this department. Number two is, I think a lot of men and women who can leave are leaving. They know what it's like not to be supported. And you literally are sacrificing your future with qualified immunity going out the window, right, and with an independent board deciding if you acted unethically or not, because he's going to pick his own board members and take that power away from the commissioner.
Yeah, that's not good news. I want to talk about the BBC. They edited Trump's January the 6th speech. One anchor over there says the majority of BBC's board of directors feels institutional bias against Trump. Brian, I think the media is changing. The hate Trump brigade, I think, is in retreat at the Washington Post, CBS News, maybe CNN, and maybe TikTok as well. Are you seeing that kind of shift in the media?
TikTok, no. And I'm telling you right now, there's more negativity. I don't get TikTok because I don't want the Chinese controlling what I think, and I don't want them understanding who's following me or anything like that. And until the president pulls off this deal, I'm not going to touch it. But I think their algorithm is very anti-American. And by the way, the White House, look at the reviews on the White House feed. Most of them are negative. Ever since Trump won, they've been very negative. But the rest of the social media, I see a big change. Obviously, X was the first. Number two, when it comes to other changes, CBS will be next. They're not going to be pro-Trump, and nobody wants pro-Trump. You just want fair. Hey, he did this right. I don't agree with this. That's what everybody wants. If you start being too pro-Trump, people turn you off because they think whatever you do, whatever he does, you're going to make excuses for him. But if people are all anti-Trump, that's what 96% of the people have been witnessing. And it got so bad, they said, there's got to be something here. There's got to be something here that I'm going to be in control of my own thoughts and my own news feed. So I do think it's changing. For the BBC, I can't do the definitive biography of the history of the BBC, but most of the time when you turn in, it's anti-American and very anti-Trump. So you lived it. So I'm encouraged by the self-regulation.
A new season of your show, Field of Valor, it's just available now on Fox Nation. Quick preview, please. Roll it.
Go ahead. Captain.
You have the first captain of the Army Corps of Cadets. That's like the number one cadet on campus at West Point. And then to be the captain of the Army football team, he said, really, that is viewed as a close second.
So what you're going to see in this series, Stuart, you're going to see people who are at the height of their athletic career who decide, I'm going to put on the uniform voluntarily. Others get drafted. See you in 2 years. You know, you had Ted Williams, who goes back twice, who goes into the Korean War. You have Yogi Berra, plays on D-Day. So I just think this is a perfect day, Veterans Day, to go to Fox Nation and watch this series, especially if you're a sports fan and you want some balance. You give it all on the field, but then you just dress like everybody else and be one of the guys and one of the soldiers, because when it comes to battle, they don't know who's famous and who's not. That's why I think it's especially important today.
You got it. Brian, good stuff indeed on this Veterans Day.
You got
it. We appreciate it. See you again soon, Brian.
Thanks. Stuart. 1-866-408-7669. Yeah, new season of Field of Valor. I think you're going to love it. It's on Fox Nation. If you don't have the app, go get it. But if you want to order it, go to foxnation.com, and you'll see some great profiles. Many people you know, you have no idea that they served. Think about it. Everybody was getting drafted almost our entire lives until the 1970s. You would say to people, you know, when are you going in? Before or after college? What are you going to be doing? What branch are you going to choose? That was the small talk. And, of course, the Vietnam War was raging and then World War II. But the draft continued. We continued to stay ready. But now we have a truly professional military, people that choose to go in. And we've seen how they perform at an extremely high level almost all the time. I think that this generation is totally underappreciated because people look at Iraq and they say, wow, you know, I don't love that outcome. Or they looked at Afghanistan, the way we got out, and say, I don't love that outcome. It doesn't mean our men and women didn't adapt to the fight over the period of years, didn't quit, and then also tried to build up a country, not for our sake, but for their sake. But the more I think about it, I'm more and more to the way of Donald Trump saying before we left Iraq, we should have said a percentage of your oil until we're paid back, especially the families that lost their lives over there. But that's what Veterans Day is. But not only is it Veterans Day today with the biggest parade right here in New York City, but it's 250 years of America and 250 years of our armed fighters, because this war really started in 1775. So that's when the service began and the sacrifice began for an idea of a country. And then we end up having that country. And then you have the Civil War that almost tore apart the country. And then we emerge after World War I and World War II as the number one superpower economically and militarily in the world, as China tries to challenge us today. But the one thing you can do, if you want to avoid a war, you build up an army and build up a military so strong that people don't want to mess with you. That's what the president believes. The best way to avoid a war is to show you're willing to fight and have the army to do some damage and win. And that's what's happened. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. What I started to say before, History, Liberty, and Laughs, coming up on February 15th at Fort Myers, Florida. BrianKilmeade.com for tickets on Fox Nation.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country and around the world, the Brian Kilmeade Show rolling through. And we do have some good news. You know, I know you're going through hell at the airports. I know you're looking at your app and saying, I can't believe my flight was canceled. But the good news is we're virtually back in action now. So I think it's a matter of time. They're going to have the House vote and soon they're going to get the back pay, a big check, hopefully right before Thanksgiving and then leading into the holidays. And maybe you'll realize that the cushion that was there got you so worried it'll be back and things will be okay. Just a quick note, Field of Valor is a series where we talk about athletes that have served in the military. Because today's Veterans Day, the 250th Veterans Day, or the 106th Veterans Day Parade in New York City, but the 250th marking of our military in our country, 1775 is really when we started. We got Field of Valor. I think it's a perfect day to get Fox Nation, and I'll play a clip a little bit later on. But right now, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
And to all those protesters outside, I have one thing to say. It is clear to us which side is winning when your side becomes the violent agitators.
Great point. And that is the leader of the UC Berkeley Turning Point chapter. They go into the belly of the radical left-wing beast as Berkeley has violence erupt but does not stop. The packed house and array of speakers making sure the end of the Turning Point tour ends up on a high note.
Number two.
We want to see Syria become a country that's very successful, and I think this leader can do it. I really do. I think this leader can do it. And people said he's had a rough past. We've all had rough pasts.
Not like that. Another first. President Trump becomes the first to invite Syrian leader to the White House, any Syrian leader, as the former terrorist state is making steps to be an ally. But is it worth the risk with a former al-Qaeda member? We discuss.
Number one.
Either all eight senators who voted to capitulate coincidentally are not up for re-election in 2026, or Chuck Schumer worked behind the scenes to give into the Republicans while still protecting vulnerable Democrats, including himself.
shutdown over what could be the end of Schumer as the minority leader. Where do we go from here as we try to reboot our country? We'll talk about how devastating this was for Democrats who were on a high after their off-year election victory, because it wasn't so much they won everywhere. They won in Mississippi and they won in Georgia. So I think that's going to be the key. And I think that this hour you're going to be hearing for some important people, too, including Nicole Parker, who has a brand new book out about her days in the FBI and what led to her joining the FBI, which is an extremely important book I hope everyone reads. So first off, when it comes to the shutdown, it is basically over. And basically, it's because after 6-7 weeks, the pain was too great. And some sensible Democrats said, I know what it's like to be the party in power. And I know what the party, what it's like to be in the minority party. Republicans aren't going to give in to extortion because you don't like the way things are going and they need 60 votes. You deny them the 60 votes. The government gets shut down. Maybe you benefited during the election, but the Republicans aren't going to budge on pure precedent. If they give in now, what else do they want? But because after all these weeks, you had Republican Democrats cave like Senator Masto, Senator Durbin, Fetterman, Hassan, Kane and King and Shaheen and Rosen, just enough to get to 60. Rand Paul bowed out because he's an ideologue. You get to 60, you open up the government, and now the bad guys are the ones who did the right thing. And I hope you hold me accountable, because I believe if Republicans did this, I'd feel the same exact way. Here's John Fetterman, who gets it. Cut 7.
I know it pays the bills in parts of the party now, and I refuse to engage those kinds of a thing. Basically, I'm not sure why those things are, I mean, be unapologetically supportive of Israel. And now I can be very, very pro-immigration as a Democrat, but we have to secure our border. And what was happening years before, that wasn't sustainable.
Right. Jeanine Shaheen joined me yesterday, too. So she stepped up. You know, they wanted to quit 2 weeks ago, according to Axios. And Schumer said, please don't. Now, I'm not his advocate, not his chief of staff, but Schumer just gave you the longest shutdown ever. And you wanted to show your constituents, your base, that you're willing to fight. I'm pretty sure that's fight. But in terms of tangible gains, you got a promise to reinstate the people that got fired when the shutdown started. All right. And you got John Thune's word, Senator Thune's word, that he'll put up for a vote extending the Obamacare subsidies, put out there during the pandemic, which was supposed to expire. When they expire, all of a sudden the Republicans are the bad guys. Listen to how mad Democrats are. Here's Senator Peter Welch of Vermont, cut 10.
The division was on the question of whether the continuation of the shutdown would be effective. You know, people were being harmed. The 8 who made that decision were not doing anything other than saying it's time.
So it is time. And for all these other people to do the right thing, I think they need to be lauded. It ends the lockout. It's over. You didn't have power. You couldn't expect to win unless Republicans really were stupid. Here's more. Cut 22.
Oh, I think this whole thing stinks. And I think most members of the House caucus on the Democratic side are absolutely outraged.
We'll continue that fight today, tomorrow, this week, next week, this month, next month, this year, next year.
What this Senate is about to do is make a horrific situation even worse.
There's no way to defend this. And you are right to be angry about it. I'm angry about it.
The president is kind of getting what he wanted.
It doesn't feel like a gentleman's agreement. It feels like Lucy and the football.
Now you're going to open the government up, and what did you get in return?
Right.
Nothing?
Right.
Nothing? This is the end of Chuck Schumer as we go forward.
I think Chuck Schumer, his days are over. If he cannot keep his caucus together, if he cannot keep his caucus together, he needs to go. He needs to be replaced.
Keep a caucus together? They kept together for 60 days. There's no one's ever for 41 days. No one's ever done it that long. Well, look, you get rid of them. Go ahead. But you want some extremist out there that will never give in? Then the country will never open, because Republicans have the power, but they don't have the 60 votes. They're never going to give in. But I think it's also important that Kevin McCarthy knew what Chuck Schumer knew in March, Kevin McCarthy knew before. Don't shut the government down. Unless it's something extreme, you don't shut the government down. And I hope they pass a law to not allow either party to shut the government down, because the innocent people who are federal employees, some really good people at TSA and the air traffic controllers and federal jobs across the country. They got stability when they got those jobs. Not everybody thinks that people don't work hard in the federal government. That is not true. And I know most of them would love to know ahead of time if they weren't going to get paid. And I think they deserve better. No doubt about it. They don't get rich in doing so. But the whole fact that it collapsed, John Stewart, somebody blames Chuck Schumer, says Democrats were on a roll after that off-year election, and they blew it. So here's a little of John Stewart. He compares what he saw with the Giants firing their coach, and he saw with the Democrats stop the lockout. Something's the same. Watch.
This is a world-class collapse by Democrats. It would be like being up 10 points with 3 minutes left to go in a game and still finding a way to miraculously lose it for the fourth time in just 1 month. For those of you who don't follow the New York football Giants, because let's say you value your time on this earth, this is a football team that on three separate occasions this season has blown games that, statistically speaking, based on their sizable leads vis-a-vis the amount of time left in the athletic contest, they had a 95% to 99% chance of winning. I refer you, for instance, to this win probability chart from Sunday's game against the Chicago Bears, where you can see the New York Giants' chance of victory climbs to 97% before they trip on their own and fall down a flight of stairs. And again, I don't want to get too inside football here, but you're not supposed to. I have not had a good weekend.
It's true. I know what he's saying. I had have a good weekend. And then finally, he goes on to finish it all up.
Now, for those of you who believe that professional sports and politics are an inept comparative, not only did the Democrats and Giants lose in the same I can't f***ing believe it manner, they sound the same doing it.
It's natural and appropriate to feel deep disappointment.
Disappointing outcome.
It was not the result many of us wanted.
You want to get the results that you hoped for and came up short?
It never feels good to come up short.
We came up short, and that was a tough one.
You learn and you prepare to do better in the future.
You're always learning and trying to be better.
Well, not enough wins. Not enough wins.
We will win. We will win. We will win. We won't rest. We won't rest.
Inspired yet?
It's just terrible. It's just absolutely terrible on both sides. I'm not sure. I thought John Gruden should be hired next, but then someone told me since he's suing the NFL, he couldn't probably do that, and Barstool pays him well. All right, when we come back, we're going to talk to Kunta Ahmed, and she is somebody who lived in the Middle East a lot of her life, going to get a perspective on what's happening now, as well as the big Syrian president visit. Was it worth the risk? We'll find out. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news. Unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Has President Trump raised with you, discussed with you, your own past affiliation with Al-Qaeda terrorism?
I think this is a matter of the past. Now, we did not discuss this actively. We talked about the president and the future. We talked about the investment opportunities in the future in Syria, and so that Syria is no longer looked at as a security threat. It is now looked at as a geopolitical ally and a place where the United States can have great investments, especially extracting gas.
So that was through a translator. That's Ahmed al-Shara. He's the new president of Syria, and he was at the White House playing basketball with the military. And a lot of people say, well, this guy was in al-Qaeda. Why are we doing that? Is it worth the risk? And so far, it's proven worth the risk for someone in this area. Kunta Ahmed joins us now, true Middle East expert, great friend of the show. Great to see you, doctor, and your thoughts about the significance of the president's meeting yesterday.
Brian, great to see you, and happy Veterans Day.
Thank you.
I mean, it's very truthful. His background is from Al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra, ISIS, and then HTS. So he has this record. But I believe, and I learned from speaking to leaders in the region, including General Mazloum, the commander of the Syrian Democratic Forces, and President Nechiban Barzani, a president of Iraqi Kurdistan, Syria has no other option right now. And so the international community is supporting to work with him, but President Trump must hold him accountable to protect the minorities. That's non-negotiable.
What's happening on the ground, Izzy?
Well, at the moment, there is a degree of tension. We don't really know how this is going to turn out. Northeast Syria, which is under the protection of the Syrian Democratic Forces, with allied with the United States, not only are the minorities protected there, the Kurds, the Christians, the Yazidis, secular Muslim Arabs that are not Islamists, but they're also fleeing from the area where the Druze were threatened in the southwest. So refugees are beginning to come in there. In major parts of Syria, there's lawlessness, instability, and areas where extremists, including ISIS, can roam.
Wow, that's important to point out. I know, don't know how big his army is, how much it's extended, but he doesn't have full control of his country. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, that's true. And what I heard is he has approximately 50,000 people under his command. He's gathered a very elite group that he trusts around himself, not exactly an inclusive cabinet. So that's worrying to Syria, that's pluralist, full of all these other ethnicities and religions. And below here, below ranks, they are outright jihadists, and they don't hide their extremism. That's what I learned on the ground.
So why is he visiting Moscow?
Well, Russia had a major influence in Syria, if you recall. Russia also, I think, still holds those bases on the coastal region. And at the moment, what we're seeing is a huge global competition for influence in Syria, foremost Turkey. While al-Sharqi met with President Trump, the foreign minister of Turkey was also in the building, presumably attending meetings. And Saudi Arabia is also exercising influence. If the U.S. doesn't have a big footprint, China and Russia will move back in. And the goal is to keep Iran out, which is still trying to make inroads.
Right. But that, do you think it's possible? These guys hate each other. We know Iran single-handedly sustained Assad along with Russia. And I'm sure he's very aware of that, correct?
I understand that. But as you pointed out, al-Sharqi doesn't yet have governance to every element of the society. There can be no powerful government there unless it's fully decentralized. That's another very important message from the region. That means the provinces where the minorities live must have their local government interact with a central government. Iran, I am told by sources, is still in contact with ex-Assad regime military leaders and trying to recreate smuggling groups and resurrect its proxy groups, which is a hazard for Israel and the United States and the Syrian Democratic Forces.
And we
forces.
Could, add, if you know it too, Doctor, you know that the U.S. can really be of help there. Do you, and they really want our presence to remain in Syria, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, when I went there by road and met the General Mazloom, the Syrian Democratic Forces are so grateful for the United States. It was so welcoming to be there as an American. And that is what the United States needs to do. There's talk that there will be an American base maybe built in Damascus, but the U.S. has to have a big footprint in northeast Syria, which it can manage from Erbil, where we're very well established in northern Iraq and where American troops not only are welcome, they have never lost a single American soldier in Iraqi Kurdistan. In fact, they go there to vacation.
So here's what when this is what he said when asked about taking out ISIS. Cut 28.
Did you commit to having the country join the coalition to fight ISIS in the Middle East?
We participated in so many battles against Daesh, against ISIS for 10 years, and we have suffered a lot during these battles, and I have lost much of my forces in the battles against ISIS. There are reasons for the presence of the United States militarily in Syria. It needs to be with the coordination with the Syrian government right now. So we need to discuss these matters, and we need to talk about and get into an agreement about ISIS.
And I guess they did sign a declaration to join the global coalition against the Islamic State. So it
that was expected. I was there about 10 days ago. Both the president, Barzani of Iraqi Kurdistan, and General Mazloom explained that this was being discussed and they were in support of that. It holds him accountable to an international body. ISIS is a threat. There are at least 2,500 fighters that are loose in Syria. And also the Syrian Democratic Forces protect both the Al-Hol camp, which is home to the ISIS wives and children, the camp that I visited, full of generations of radicalized extremist families, and 10,000 ISIS fighters. That's stable there because of U.S. partnership with the SDF. And so those fighters need to be very carefully contained, and those families.
So it looks like Hezbollah has gotten about $1 billion from Iran since we struck their nuclear plant, since they've been beaten up by the IDF. Your real 30 seconds, Dr. Ahmed, your thoughts on that?
Hezbollah is down but not out. And also, I want Americans to pay attention to Iraq, because there are Iranian-backed militias in Iraq that are also a huge threat. They've sort of kept a low profile and they've been unscathed by Israel so far. So these problems are not fully eliminated. And Israel needs to be supported by the United States to keep
Iran,
the deterrent on.
You got it. Iran's a problem, whether it's Iraq or Lebanon, they're still the problem. Thanks so much, Dr. Ahmed.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's with me right now is a very familiar face. She's got a brand new book out. It's Nicole Parker, the former FBI agent, special agent, I should say, Fox News contributor. And she has this new book out. It's called Two FBIs, The Bravery and Betrayal I Saw in My Time at the Bureau. And you go back in the very beginning, Nicole, and talked about you were not thinking you're going to spend any of your time at the FBI. But 9/11 changed everything.
That's right. You know, I worked with several FBI agents and they dreamed of being an agent since I think the day that they were born. And I didn't come from a law enforcement family. I, you know, was working for Merrill Lynch at the time that 9/11 occurred. And that day completely changed my life. I was 23 years old, came from Texas. Brian, to see people jumping from the World Trade Center and crashing to the ground, that does something to you. And when that second plane hit the South Tower of the World Trade Center, we were rushing out of our building in the World Financial Center, and I will never forget a moment in the elevator where I felt strongly in my heart, if I get out of here, I want to give back and serve my country one day. I didn't know what that would look like or when or how.
Or what was happening either.
Right. I mean, again, it was total chaos and pandemonium, but I stayed in finance until 2009, and that's when I applied to be an FBI special agent.
And with your finance background, how did you win them over?
At the FBI?
Yeah. Like, how did they realize you could do it?
Well, what's interesting is that it was someone from Wall Street that I worked with. I was on a trip to New York. I was working for a hedge fund in Beverly Hills at the time. And I met with a friend from Wall Street that I'd worked with. And he said, you know, Nicole, you should apply to the FBI, because this was around the time of the subprime mortgage meltdown. He's like, you know, they could send you into these companies and you could do all this undercover work and bust up all these people. And so the FBI traditionally had wanted people that were accountants, finance, attorneys, you know, engineers, prior law enforcement, military. So I came in under the finance background to the FBI. And so that's really what I did. I started off on white collar, worked it for 4 years with my background, and then I shifted into violent crime.
And you mentioned there were two FBIs. You saw the part you loved and the part you hated.
Correct.
The part you loved.
The part that I loved is that I was coming in to serve my country and that I was working shoulder to shoulder with true patriots and warriors, and we just wanted to uphold the Constitution in a fair and unbiased manner and protect Americans. After witnessing the 9/11 terrorist attack, I never wanted something like that to ever happen again. And I didn't like to see people suffer. And I wanted to help. You know, so many people helped me on 9/11. I wanted to be the one to help others. And so I did. I went in with this idea of I'm here to serve my country. I want to protect Americans. And that's really how it started off. And it was a phenomenal experience. But then things changed, and I started noticing what I refer to as FBI 2, which is the political and social justice weaponization of the FBI. It started to creep in.
And could you give me an example of when it started happening? Because they stationed you in Miami, right?
Correct. I was called to the Miami field office. It's a very dynamic office for the FBI. I was exposed to a lot of very interesting cases. For me, the defining moment was July 5th of 2016, when James Comey, then the FBI director, came in front of the American people and held a press conference saying, in essence, that no reasonable prosecutor would charge Hillary Clinton. That's when I knew that the FBI had turned into a political pawn. rules for thee, or, you know, rules for thee, but not for me. Certain people were above the law. I will never forget that press conference. I walked outside of my boss's office and me and my other colleagues were like, isn't this interesting? This defies everything that we've ever been taught at the FBI Academy. This is not fair. This is not unbiased. This is basically the FBI giving a pass to certain individuals.
And Democrats were mad because he outlined all the cases against her, which sounds like she should be indicted. And Republicans were mad because they said, "It's why is she not indicted?"
Right.
And it got worse from there.
Oh, it got worse from there. And like I said, I believe that Jim Comey was the one who... I think there are many, many awful things that happened at the FBI, but I think he single-handedly took down the agency. And that's when the trust of the American people was lost. And so it just snowballed from there. It wasn't just Jim Comey. And we're seeing with Arctic Frost that's coming out now, everything that's mentioned in my book, it's all completely validated because I was living it. I was seeing it. I was experiencing it. And now Americans are.
Dozens of senators and congressmen had their phones tapped. And
it's disgusting. It's a total abuse of using your law enforcement power to push your own agendas. People at headquarters at the Washington field office and WFO, many of them in FBI too, they had absolutely no regard for the law. That's wrong. And there needs to be accountability and consequences for that.
Do you think that, we know about the people of Peter Strzok and others that gone back and forth. First, they lose their pensions and they get their pensions back. Then they're suing Lisa Page and all those. Now they're indicted again. Were they exposed to you when we all got exposed to them? Was that just not happening and you didn't know this was happening? Has there always been an FBI too, in other words?
Like I said, I first saw it most blatantly in July of 2016 is when we started to see it. Because again, a lot of the FBI, so FBI one, you know, these are straight shooters. These are people that are going to uphold their oath in a fair and unbiased manner.
So much crime to fight.
That's right. Like, I don't have time for that. Like, we're down here in FBI Miami. I was working on a violent crime, number one violent crime fugitive task force in the country at the time. So all this nonsense is happening up in DC at WFO. And we just kept trying to ignore it. We knew that it was happening, but we're like, you know what? It's not my problem. I'm going to focus on my cases. Well, it became my problem when I was trying to do my job completely unrelated to that nonsense. And I would be going out trying to conduct interviews, recruit sources, and people would literally slam the door in my face and say, I can't trust you. Are you like Peter Strzok and Lisa Page? And that is the most highest insult to an FBI agent who lives with honor and integrity, is to be discounted because of those that they literally destroyed the whole agency. It can just take a handful of people of FBI too to ruin it for everybody. But Brian, it started with that. But then at the end of my time at the agency, it was one thing after another after another. They were going after conservatives, Republicans, President Trump. But yet I wasn't seeing any equal enforcement of the law. If you were on the left side or progressive or Democratic right. side of the spectrum, no accountability.
Where were you when the raid happened in Mar-a-Lago?
So I was in FBI Miami when it occurred. I first learned of that raid later. It was after work. I was actually in Miami Beach and my phone started to blow up because it hit the press and everyone was asking, are you at Mar-a-Lago right now? And I was disgusted. My response was absolutely not. I would never have participated in something of that sort because you know what? What they did was wrong. Not because it's President Trump and I voted for President Trump, is because they abused their power and what they did was wrong. And now you're seeing, and we're going to see more and more and more coming out with Arctic Frost and how that
run
whole
by
raid
Jack
happened.
Smith.
Correct.
So Jack Smith, by the way, he did that raid. One thing that people have brought up to me is that protocol is you absolutely tell the Miami Bureau of the FBI that you're going to Mar-a-Lago. But you guys were never alerted except for a handful of agents you said who would be supportive of that.
Correct. There were only certain individuals, particularly out of our West Palm Beach RA. It's a resident agency of FBI Miami. But the way that it worked, Brian, in my opinion, is it became so, it was like this internal battle. It was like a civil war almost between FBI 1 and FBI 2. It never was like this when I first joined. But you knew who was on what side, and you knew who was willing to do what. And I'm sure that they all knew Nicole Parker is not someone who you will ever call on to do something that is not right because her integrity will not be penetrated. I will not do that.
And by the way, Nicole was talking about today, her book comes out, The Two FBIs, The Bravery and Betrayal, I saw in my time at the Bureau. So did you even know President Trump before all this? Did you encounter him at all in 2016 to 20?
No. Okay. No, I had not. You know what? I think I ran into President Trump when he was, a civilian back when I lived in New York City years ago while working on Wall Street. I did not personally know him. I did meet him later on. But when this all occurred, again, I had had conversations with my best friend in the FBI, Special Agent Laura Schwarzenberger. She ended up getting shot and killed in the line of duty, taking down a child predator. And that's something that I talk about in my book quite strongly, because there was no SWAT support for taking down a child predator, yet they were sending SWAT liberally and adamantly for people that conducted January 6th nonviolent misdemeanors. Can you imagine how insulting that is? It was just a misuse of power. But she and I would have conversations, and she and I talked even a lot about before she was killed. She was the one person that I really trusted there, because when you were at the agency, you didn't know who you could trust. Like, you felt like you were in a twilight zone. At the FBI, and I mention it in my book, we would joke. Some of us would joke in FBI One, but it's really sick and not funny. We truly thought that we wouldn't be shocked if they had the voter rolls and knew who each agent had voted for. And we ourselves felt like we were under attack. So Americans think, you know, the FBI was coming after you. Internally, we felt that Republicans, conservatives, Trump supporters, and Christians were also being attacked internally. We had to watch our backs. Wow. And so she and I had conversations about that at length prior to her being murdered in the line of duty.
So I know, so you president endorsed your book.
Yes.
What is your impression, what you've seen, and do you understand where he's coming from as he sits there and says, I want some justice here. You tried to put me in jail, what he's doing with James Comey in the case. You're not a lawyer, but you've gotten every other. You got the financial degrees. But do you understand where he's coming from?
Oh, absolutely. And I understand the law. We're highly trained on it. When you go to the FBI Quantico Academy, you know exactly what the laws are. And, that's what we're sworn to do, is to uphold the law. President Trump has every right to believe in equal enforcement of the law. And people are saying, you know, this is political retribution. No, what this is this should have been happening a long time ago. But under the last administrations, they were protecting all of their own people. And so now it's time for there to be accountability. Why should they only go after conservatives and Republicans? It's not about that. People that actually violated the laws were the ones that got away with breaking them. And so now this is a time when there needs to be justice, and we need to regain trust in the legal system.
You saw that huge bust that they had in New Jersey over to Michigan with would-be Al-Qaeda inspired attacks. That shows they stopped that. I heard a few others. Does this remake of the FBI with Cash Patel and Dan Bongino give you hope?
It gives me hope, because I think what we're doing is we're putting the FBI back on track. They went so far off the rails, and what I'd signed up for, the mission that I'd signed up for, I didn't even recognize what the FBI was doing. Let's get back to enforcing laws, protecting against foreign terrorist organization groups. Let's get those individuals that cross that border that really shouldn't be here, violent offenders, people that are potential terrorists, they need to get out. Cyber attacks, you know, the Chinese threat is very, very real. Violent crime. I mean, they are cracking down on violent crime. I really appreciate and respect the efforts that they're making. But Brian, it's going to take a long time, because this problem didn't start overnight. And so what Cash Patel and Pam Bondi's biggest task, in my opinion, is they've got to build up FBI One and take care of the good people and support the good people that are trying to enforce the laws and protect Americans, while simultaneously tearing down and obliterating FBI Two.
Do you think they know who's who? FBI One and Two.
I think they're learning, and that's going to take time, because what happens is these little snakes, they go in there and they'll kiss up to whoever's in charge. And that's why it's important to know certain people who know what's going on.
And Nicole, why'd you write the book?
I want Americans to know that there are good individuals at the FBI while publicly denouncing the corruption.
Right. And do you think we're close to getting it straightened out? Did we ever have a period, from what you know, where things were pretty much where people were singing from the same hymn sheet?
You know, some Americans will say the FBI has always been corrupt. But again, having worked there, witnessed it myself, I saw outstanding and amazing work. It's going to take time, but I'm telling you, FBI One is holding the line. You don't hear from them, but it is happening.
And just so you know, anytime you talk to the president, he doesn't give a broad swipe at FBI agents. He says there are certain bad ones, but he also knows a lot of good ones. So does the Trump family. They will never have a broad swipe negative definition of an FBI agent, because they know there's others have come forward and tipped them off.
And that's why I respect President Trump and his family and anyone else that can see the truth, because what I do is I speak the truth.
Right.
And President Trump can see the truth, and he has publicly acknowledged the good work of the FBI, And again, my friend who was killed in the line of duty protecting children, she's not a corrupt political hack. She deserves to be honored and her legacy should be protected.
I got it. Nicole Parker's, her book is out today. You got to go pick it up. The Bravery and Betrayal that she saw at the FBI and the Bureau. It's called The Two FBIs. Nicole, congratulations.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it.
And thanks so much for joining us. We come back, we'll find out if there's more to know, and you'll find out about a brand new series on Fox Nation. Don't move.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
He starts to compete in a lot more national level, but it takes a little bit for him to win one.
Went on to win all of the regional tournaments, but he could not win the big one.
Bobby Jones went through seven lean years where he did not win a major championship.
His good friend, Obi Keeler, would coin the seven lean years where Bobby was good, not great.
Bob was so down on himself and said to Keeler, I think I'm going to quit. I can't win the big one. I might as well quit. And he said, son, you're the greatest golfer who ever picked up a golf club. And when you get that through your skull, you'll not win just one. You'll win them all.
How inspiring is that? But Bobby Jones's story is well known by golfers, but his military service is not. That's part of Field of Valor, brand new season, as we have Veterans Day today. What a perfect time to cue it up on Fox Nation. Watch it now. Put it on your phone. Listen to it. You know, it's great to watch, but even if you're in your car right now, listen to it and get inspired because it shows the other side of athletes and what they sacrifice to get in. What they sacrificed with their careers, their best years of their careers. You know, you talk about Muhammad Ali refusing to serve, and you could have your opinions on that. He lost 3.5 years. All these other men and women that didn't lose their lives come back, and a lot of times they lose athletic ability, the peak years. But Field of Valor on Fox Nation. Let's find out if there's even more to know.
More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
So the New York Giants, my team, fired Brian Daboll, ending a turbulent four-year run that began with early some promise, because the promise gave him Coach of the Year. They were 9-7-1, won a playoff game, and they thought, this is the genius from the Buffalo Bills that helped turn around that offense and that team. Would they have it? The Giants have shown they can play with anyone this year. They've blown about four fourth-quarter leads. He almost got fired after the Broncos loss when they blew an 18-point fourth-quarter lead. After beating Philadelphia, you thought that they might end up being the hottest team in the NFL, and then they never would respond. Final score, 33-32. He gets fired. He's 20-40. Best of luck to him. I think he's a good guy. Next. ESPN Monday Night Football has got to feel good. They have reached 110 million viewers, on pace for the second most watched season in 20 years on ESPN. By the way, the Monday Night Countdown and Saturday NFL Countdown, 1.5 million and 1.3 million. We all know, in all honesty, that Fox has the best pre- and post-game shows. Prime Video's coverage of the Raiders-Broncos game on Thursday. Thursday nights are the least popular, but they're extremely popular, up 2% to 14 million. What else can I tell you? The Broncos' Alex Singleton undergoes testicular surgery after revealing this was revealed to itself after a routine drug test. So the 31-year-old feels good about it, and now that they found it early. Next, the IOC doing something I thought they did already, moving towards a ban on transgender athletes in women's Olympic events. Do you think? The IOC previously left it up to the individual sport to decide how to determine gender eligibility, but in general, guidance was transgender women and those who grew up with DSD could compete if their testosterone levels were low. A science committee reportedly told the IOC last week that being born male continued to provide physical advantages. Why are we even going over this? Of course you should not be doing this. Trump will not tolerate it. I'm telling you, he'll pull the plug on the Olympics if you let men compete in women's sports. Next. Bail is set for Guardians Luis Ortiz, set at $500,000 in his pitch rigging case. MLB, major sports books to limit prop bets now. What are prop bets? Individual bets you could do on players and kind of quirky things within a game. Number one, with the first pitch, is it going to be a ball? Like when they flip a coin in the NFL at the Super Bowl, is it heads or tails? Those are called prop bets. Well, Major League Baseball announced on Monday that major sports books will place a $200 limit on these pitch-level micro bets, as well as exclude them from potential parlays. So Ortiz could be going to jail for years. years, and Emmanuel Class would also. He's indicted on a bevy of charges relating to manipulating specific pitches for betting purposes. I mean, some of the video. He said he would pitch the first pitch a ball, and he throws it in the dirt. Next. We don't have time. Antonio Brown in trouble again. How about that? He's going to fight back against claims he tried to shoot and kill somebody at a celebrity boxing match. They pulled him out of the Middle East to indict him. Brian Kilmeade Show, keep it here. Don't move.